I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. As much as I hate to admit it, summer is almost over. That means late-season crops like eggplant, peppers, tomatoes, and onions are at their best and plentiful in local farmers' markets. It's also a great occasion to invite my friend Cindy Hodel back to town and into the kitchen. Today, she'll do her best to teach me how to make a perfect dish for late summer veggies. All I can say is good luck with that, Cindy. We'll also get an update on her life out in the Flint Hills and find out how folks in Matfield Green are preparing for the fall. Stay tuned later for this week's State House Blend. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Today we're visiting with our friend Cindy Hodel, the longtime features writer for the Kansas City Star, who now lives in the Flint Hills, and she's living the kind of life that many of us find pretty interesting. It's one filled with sunsets and hikes and meteor showers and the type of small town living that makes you think that that might be kind of fun someday. Well, this morning we're coming to you from the kitchen of KCUR staffer Brian Ellison, and we're standing right here at the stove as Cindy prepares something that looks just terrific, and allegedly she's going to give me a few cooking lessons today, which will be sort of like teaching a cow how to waltz, but we'll get to that in a moment. Cindy Hodel, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Steve. Thank you for having me.
And what do we have right here in front of us? Because it looks beautiful.
This is ratatouille. How's it smelling?
Good, really good, yeah. And it's, the colors are magnificent, too. You've got about every color in the rainbow there.
It's a color riot. It's fantastic. So what we're going to do, this needs to simmer for a little while longer. And in the meantime, I'm going to show you some basic knife skills.
Okay.
We have the first aid kit ready.
Yes. Ratatouille. I just like the sound of that word, ratatouille. It's got to be good if you say it like that, all those syllables. So, yeah.
Isn't it great?
Yes.
So first, we're going to start with a trick.
Okay.
Guys like tricks.
I like tricks.
So this is how to peel a tomato. You can impress your friends.
I got the knife. The little knife.
Big knife comes later. Little knife we'll start out with. We're going to chop just the end of my beautiful Roma tomato out of my garden.
I'm using the wrong side of this knife. Yes,
you're
I am.
Doing great.
There we go. I was using the wrong
edge
of the knife.
I wasn't going to tell.
Yeah, but there we go. I've accomplished that.
Now go to the pointy end, and you're going to, with the sharp point of the knife, just cut a little cross into it.
Oh, the sharp point of the knife. Okay, this is going to be dangerous here. Okay.
Okay, and be careful because you have your finger on the sharp part of the blade.
Yes, okay, there we go. Am I doing it?
Okay, yeah.
You do it.
Okay.
I knew this was going to be hard.
No, you're good,
yeah.
You're good.
Okay.
And now we're going to use, for safety's sake, this little dipper.
Little net. I'm going to dip it in
right.
Some boiling water here, okay? Okay, it's in there.
And it's going to sit in there for about 1 minute, and then it's going to go into this bowl of cold water that we have sitting nearby on the counter. And then what you'll discover is after this hot bath, cold bath, that skin is going to come right off. You'll be able to pull it right off with your fingers.
So why are we sitting here in this kitchen making ratatouille? And what is it about ratatouille that you wanted to bring to us today from the Flint Hills of Kansas?
Right. Well, besides trying to think of the most complicated thing that I could throw at you, one real reason
you
is...
You made it. I didn't.
Right? This is what's happening right now in the farmers markets, no matter where you go. Where I live, where you live in Kansas City... This has everything in there that you're going to come home with on Saturday. You know, a lot of times you go to the farmer's market, it all looks so pretty. You buy your eggplants, your zucchini.
And then you don't know what to do with it.
What are we going to do with it?
I've been there before.
It all goes in here. So that tomato is about ready to come out and get dropped into the cold water.
Okay, I'm taking my dipper net here and
yes,
grabbing it out of the boiling water and shaking it off and just drop it in here.
Exactly.
And okay.
And it only needs to be in that cold water for just a few seconds, just long enough to cool off, because the skin is already loose.
Okay. So now the task is going to be to peel the skin off this tomato, right?
Exactly. And it should come right off with your fingertips. And if it doesn't, you can use your friend, the little sharp paring knife.
Well, it better come off with my fingertips here. We're all going to be in trouble. It's peeling right off.
Isn't that easy?
That's just amazing. Yeah. I've never done this before because... People who know me know that I don't spend a lot of time cooking.
Now you're going to want to do this all the time.
This is kind of cool.
Yeah.
It's peeling right off, sort of like big peels from an orange, and this is like cool.
Exactly. And so once you know how to do that, you can make everything taste better. All your salsas that you make, your spaghetti sauce, you just take that tomato then and put it into a pot with a little seasoning and olive oil, and you let it simmer, and now you have your own base for whatever tomato stuff you want to make.
Okay, how do I know when all the peel's off? Because it's like it's close.
Yeah,
it's
you're not... very close. There's one little piece that's stuck on there, and Romas hold their skin tighter than big, fat, juicy slicing tomatoes, so we're just going to scrape that off with the knife.
Yeah, you're scraping it off, not me.
Now we graduate to the great big knife, the chef's knife.
Oh, this is a monster knife. Yeah, this is like the Alfred Hitchcock movie Psycho knife. Okay, yeah.
Hands.
Okay, yes.
So the first thing, when you are dealing with round vegetables like eggplant and zucchini, those can roll around on the cutting board, which we don't want. So we're going to chop off the stem end here first.
I'm going to go left-handed here, right here.
Excellent. Perfect.
Okay.
Now chop off the bottom, a little piece off the bottom.
Okay.
Now you're going to cut it lengthwise in half.
Lengthwise in half.
Lengthwise in half. And you're doing it exactly right. Always keep the blade down towards the bottom. I am so impressed.
Well, don't be, because the disaster is just around the corner here. Okay.
Now we're going to put, the reason why we want like to do that is you're going to put the flat side down on the cutting board, and now that isn't going to want to roll around on you when you chop it.
I'm going to cut
and
little
now
pieces.
You're going to start making little half moon shapes.
Like that?
Perfect.
Okay.
Perfect.
The staff is laughing here because they know this is not my natural habitat. And they think this is very funny here to watch the inept host try to chop stuff and do stuff. Yeah.
You look like a pro.
Okay, watch the fingers. There we go.
Fantastic. Okay, and now all of that is going to go in here. And when you're chopping all the vegetables for this dish, you want to make sure that they're all more or less the same size. But don't agonize about it.
This too?
Yeah.
Okay.
You want to cut your eggplant, your squash, your onions, all in kind of 1-inch square pieces so that they cook evenly, but just don't worry about it. Okay, perfect,
okay.
We're done.
Okay.
Now, you get to use the big knife again for garlic.
Oh,
so there's a lot of gadgets out there for getting the peel off garlic and mincing it. I just use the big chef's knife for everything.
And what am I doing here?
The first thing you're going to do is you want to cut off this little dried piece at the end, flat piece. Yeah.
Okay.
Just chop that right off.
It's off.
And now here comes the fun part.
Okay.
You're going to use the flat part of your knife. You're going to lay that on top and you're going to crush it.
I've seen people do
so
this
really
before.
Put some force into it, Steve.
Force.
Yeah. Lean into it.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Danny Alexander's giving me the thumbs up like I'm doing it right. Okay.
Oh, that was so great.
When Danny praises me in the kitchen, that's high praise indeed. Yeah.
Okay. Now you're going to pick the skin off of it and put it in our little compost bowl over there.
Okay.
And now you're just going to chop up the remaining piece.
Small bits.
Yeah, just little. And I'll show you a cheater way at the end to get it even smaller. Just kind of chop it as little as you can, quickly and easily. Nice.
There you go.
I like the percussion.
There you go. Okay.
Okay. And now you're going to smash it one more time. You're going to get to do the smash thing.
Smash thing again.
That'll just help it dissolve in our sauce really nicely.
Okay. Okay.
Perfect.
How's that?
That's great.
Then scrape it off where?
Yeah. Right here.
Right here. Okay. And here too?
Yeah, and just lots and lots of garlic goes into the ratatouille.
I believe in that. That's a good philosophy to have. Okay.
Always more.
All right. And now what?
Now we're going to talk about the origins of the ratatouille. This is a southern French dish. The name, because we both like words,
yes,
it comes from a French verb that means stir. So touille in French means stir, and then ta is a diminutive, so this is like a little stirrup. And if you need to get inspiration for making this dish, I suggest the Pixar movie Ratatouille.
There's a movie?
Did you ever see? You haven't seen Ratatouille?
I have not.
The animated Pixar movie with the little mouse?
Uh-uh. There's a whole movie on Ratatouille. Okay.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
It's a great film. It's an animated film, but adults like it just as much as kids.
How long ago did it come out?
5 years? 6 years? I don't know. But yeah, you definitely need to watch that movie. It's very sweet. And it has a serious preparation in it. Pixar sent researchers into the kitchen of Thomas Keller, who has the French Laundry, in California, a very famous restaurant, and they, to get all of their animated moves right, like I'm showing you how to hold a knife and how to chop, they went into this big kitchen and learned how to chop and do knife skills so that they would look right on the film. So I highly, it's a great film. You should watch it, and then you'll really want to make this.
Well, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're coming to you live from the home of KCUR staffer Brian Ellison in Midtown, Kansas City. We're joined by our longtime friend Cindy Hodel, the longtime feature writer for the Kansas City Star, who now lives in the Flint Hills. And we're talking about ratatouille and the preparation of here in Brian Ellison's kitchen. How often do you make this dish?
I always make it this time of year, and I'll usually make it twice, and I always make a large batch of it. And the recipe that listeners can find on the website is enough that you can eat it once or twice for dinner that week that you make it. I would make it on the weekend because it takes about 2 hours, but most of that is just roasting and simmering. So it's passive, not active time. It's easy, but make it on the weekend, and then that'll give you one or two dinners, because it only gets better and better for the next 2 or 3 days when it sits in your fridge.
Why does it get better?
The flavors just kind of mingle and blend. Like people say that about chili and spaghetti sauce. Mm-hmm. And then freeze some of it, because it's an excellent way to freeze the summer flavors that we love this time of year, and then enjoy them in January when it's really cold outside.
Now, how often when you cook this, do the neighbors come over and they can smell Cindy's cooking from down the street and they come over, because you guys do things together in the Flint Hills a lot of times. There's this whole shared cooking thing going on.
We do. In my town, Little Matfield Green, which has about 50 people, about half of them are locals, and about half of us intentionally moved there from somewhere else, from Wichita, from Kansas City, from Holland, from far-flung places. And so we have a very strong sense of community, because we've all self-selected either to move there or not to move away from there. Mm-hmm. And so we love a lot of the things you mentioned at the top of the show, looking at the stars and walking in the prairie. But a group of us have also been trying to very intentionally preserve what I would call the heritage food ways of the Midwest. Like, let's learn how to cook, if we missed it, the things that our grandparents used to eat. Instead of trying out something off Pinterest that's brand new and trendy, let's make the food that our ancestors ate around here.
Hey, do people get along? I mean, they get together. That's kind of a gamble to move into a town. You don't know anybody, and here you are sharing so much of your lives together. How's that working out?
I think that's an interesting idea, and I think the reason it works out is because we've self-selected, and so we're interested in a lot of the same things. We all like nature. We all prefer the analog world to the digital world. Mm-hmm. We can do the digital, and you have to nowadays. You know, we order things on Amazon, and they come in the brown UPS truck. But we love to buy old machines and kitchen tools at auctions and then get together and go, like, we have a sausage grinder, let's make sausage.
Yeah, tell me about the auction. I was going to ask you in our second half, there's a place where you go where old farm implements are sold off. What's that experience like?
That is the most fun thing in the entire world, Steve. And
Describe it to us.
You go out to an old farmstead where maybe the elderly people that live there are moving into town a little bit closer. And so for whatever reason, this stuff needs to be sold, because a lot of times the heirs, if it was my grandparents moving, I would just take all the stuff. But a lot of young people, they want more modern stuff, or they live in the city. And so you have an auction. And so first you auction off the dishes, the towels, the tools, and then you go and you break and you sell off the wonderful tractors and the big old trucks. And then you break and sell the house. And then you come back and get the rest of the antiques.
How many people gather for these things down in Matfield Green?
Oh, like 50 to 100 would show up, I would say.
And what do you like to buy?
Oh, gosh. Embroidered pillowcases, embroidered tea towels. I have about every kitchen utensil you can think of that has either a red melamine or a red wooden painted handle on it.
What does like an old farm truck go for? I mean, we're talking just a few hundred bucks typically, or these things go, I know it depends on the truck, but.
It does, but the short answer is much less than it would in the city.
Right.
Yeah, you should come down and buy yourself an old pickup truck for sure.
You can drive it right off the lot.
Right.
Presumably it runs.
Yes.
Yeah. Do they all run?
A lot of them
are just sitting there, right?
A lot of them do, and that's part of the entertainment is they'll turn it on right before they sell it. Like, okay, we got her going.
Okay. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation with City Hodel about life in the Flint Hills. We'll maybe eat some ratatouille here, and we'll do a bunch of other stuff here, too. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's program, the Smart Money Expert shared financial planning advice for non-traditional couples. You can find that conversation online at kcur.org and on the NPR One app. Tomorrow, we talk with local pediatrics experts who have some tips for helping babies and infants sleep through the night so you can too. That's important when you're a new parent. We'll talk about it tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, today we're coming to you from the Midtown kitchen of KCUR staffer Brian Ellison. We're visiting with our longtime friend Cindy Hodel, who lives down in the Flint Hills and comes on every once in a while to talk about life down there and what's happening. And we just were kicking around in the kitchen here, Cindy, with some ratatouille. You clearly love to cook. Where does that come from in your life?
I need to be careful. My mom might be listening. It does not come from my parents. And Jill Silva, the food editor at The Star, she and I have often noted when I was a food writer and we would travel around the country to these conferences of other food writers, most people that like to cook and get into food journalism, either they had parents that loved to cook and cooked very, very well, or the opposite. There's nothing in the middle, right? And so I did not know anything about cooking, how to cook, until I studied a year in France when I was in college. And over there, that's not an option to not cook. Everyone cooks.
So then you had to figure it out, and you did.
Right.
What do you like about it? What's the joy for you?
Oh, where do I start? It's textural. It's you were holding that tomato with your hand. You know, I love the feel of it. I love it when the shiny skin is on it. I love it when you peel that back and it's a different kind of velvety texture on the inside. I love chopping things. I find that kind of meditative. Nowadays, a lot of people try to rush through the prep part of a recipe because they're only thinking about that finished dish and getting done. And I think you'll never really cook very well if you do that until you get to a point where you're actually enjoying the process.
And for you, so much of the food that you're preparing is coming from your own garden. And that changes things too, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And I've had this conversation with my sister who loves to eat in restaurants. And I like to eat in restaurants less and less the more that I cook and the more that I grow my own food because I know the flavors that I like. And a lot of times I'm disappointed at a restaurant, you spend all this money. And sometimes I'm thinking like, I could have made that better.
You know, tell us more about these shared meals that you enjoy down in the Flint Hills. How do those come together? How do people gather? And how many people might come together for any one meal?
We do a really neat thing in the wintertime. We have a neighbor who lives half of the year in Maine. And then, if you can believe it, she winters in Matfield Green. So she's in Maine for the summer because I guess you wouldn't want to winter there. And so she's with us for 6 months in the winter. And she has this beautiful long farm table in her kitchen. And she just decided like twice a month, two Sundays a month, we're going to have a community potluck. And there's no invitation. There's no e-vite. If you're around Sunday evening at 6, the first or the third Sunday, just show up and just bring something.
What are those meals like?
They're wonderful because you have all generations. You have people in their 70s down to little children. There's a 2-year-old. And we cook together and then we eat together. And then sometimes we play games afterwards.
I imagine that's important because down in Matfield Green in the wintertime, people need to come together somewhere because it's hard to find a crowd anywhere.
Sure. And we do. We like each other a lot. Like I said, this is a group of people where it's a little bit different than just if you took a random city block, it would be unusual that many people would all get along so well. But because we have the population of a city block spread out over this very large geographic area, but we've all come there for the same things. We love nature, and we would rather cook and talk to each other than be on our phones.
And how often do you guys, you have a meal and then some other times you go out at night and you're looking at the meteors, you're looking at the planets, you're looking at the stars?
Sure.
That just sounds incredibly restorative to me.
And what's great is what we've noticed is, and this might surprise some people in the city, the local people enjoy nature just as much as we do, who it's all new to us. But the people that have lived their whole lives there have told me, we never get tired of this. We love this. And local people organize watch parties, you know, to sit out and we watch the meteor showers. You know, I had three different local people invite us to watch the meteor shower out on their land. And I think we went to two of them.
Maybe it's obvious to a lot of people, but how different is the sky at night in Little Matfield Green than it is from Kansas City, Missouri?
The first night that my husband and I slept in the house, I walked outside and looked up and then I said, oh, there's some low hanging clouds. And then he said, that's the Milky Way. Put your glasses on.
You're kidding me.
No. And so we can see the Milky Way from our house. So we don't even have to go out like on the open range to see that. That's like every night. And I've learned all the planets, you know, Venus is my constant companion out there in the wintertime. I can always see Venus. Sometimes you can see as many as three or four planets with your bare eye. You can see Jupiter is one that you can see. You can see Mars.
Do you do the periscope, telescope thing?
No, because I can see so many of them. I haven't done that yet. Maybe one day I'll do that.
Well, going back to these shared meals, you've mentioned that you sometimes share catfish fries and bull fries. What are we talking about there?
Okay, so everybody knows what catfish.
I feel like I'm on Mars now. Yeah.
Everybody knows
okay.
what catfish are. So we have these wonderful streams and rivers that are full of really big, I think they're called channel cat. I'm not a fisherman, but people go down and set up a campsite around the bend of a stream, and then people fish, and then they cut up these catfish, and then you've got a big turkey fryer, basically. And then you set up, you know, kind of camp style. You have your bowl with your batter, and people make them different ways. But generally, they cut the pieces of catfish meat up into the size of like a large chicken McNugget, and then batter it, and then drop it into this hot grease. And then just somebody standing there just continually cooking these pieces and putting them out on paper towels. And everybody just sits around in folding chairs and eats.
What about bull fries?
So I don't
know.
Which
one do you like better?
I definitely like the catfish better,
okay.
But I will eat the bull fries.
What are those?
Do you know, do you really not know what they are?
I don't know what they are, but I your hesitation is making me even more interested.
Does Rocky Mountain oyster mean anything
yes,
to you?
Yes, it sure does. Okay, that's where
Thank
we're going
Thank you for
here.
Saving yeah. me from using yeah. a more descriptive term. So we have cattle in the Flint Hills, and so this is a natural byproduct of things that go on ranches.
So that's what...
Right. And so people have different ways. Some people, I've heard soaking them in milk makes them taste better, and then batter them and fry them. And it's basically, it's a fried food. And
you
know, I like them.
You say that your interest in shared experiences goes deep. How so? It goes beyond the shared meal thing.
Sure. So anybody in the city can get together and have a dinner party with friends, and that's a wonderful thing. But we take it a little bit farther. We're looking at how can we get together to prepare food, to harvest the food, to forage for the food. There's a lot of free food in rural areas. You learn where the asparagus grows in the ditch, or where the elderberries grow in the ditch, and you pick them and you make jelly out of it, or where the wild mulberry trees are, and you put a sheet down on the ground, and then you catch the mulberries in the sheet, and you make jelly, or you make a shrub for a cocktail.
You know, it sounds so wonderful, and I'm just thinking of us city slickers listening to this, thinking, yeah, maybe I'd like to try that. But what was the transition like for you going from big city life to something very, very different in Matfield Green?
Well, you're old enough that you know what Green Acres is, and it was a little bit like that.
I am old enough to remember Green Acres, yeah.
It was, yeah,
there were Green Acres moments, and there still are, I'm sure.
Do you remember what one of them was?
Not knowing, over and over, not knowing what things are. And seeing a coyote and asking a local friend if that's a prairie dog. Mm-hmm. Because it turns out a prairie dog is a rodent. But I thought, well, it's a dog that's out on the prairie. And we have a lot of coyotes. And
I might have said something like that. Yeah. But one other thing you do is you help neighbors harvest meat chickens.
Right.
That must have been an experience the first time out of the gate.
That was really an eye-opener for a city kid, because I had asked some local friends, where can I find local chickens? And then they said, well, as a matter of fact, we raise them and you can help us harvest them. And then you can take a couple home for the freezer. And then gulp, right?
Yeah.
I was so nervous, but immediately I thought, like, okay, I have to go all the way there because I'm living out on the land. I say I want this closer connection to the earth,
right,
and to the food that goes in my mouth. If I'm going to eat chicken, I need to be willing to kill that chicken.
So what was that first time like?
Fortunately, I did not have to kill the chicken. I was prepared to do it. But what I discovered, a cool thing is the farmers that raise the meat that we eat, they care deeply about those animals. And often the person who raises the chickens wants to be the one that ends the chicken's life to make sure that it's done comfortably and quickly and competently.
Could you do it?
I think I could, Steve. I really do. But I prefer just plucking them.
You also know two guys who roast their own coffee and you've traded eggs for them. What happens there?
So this is a great thing that's happening in my town. One couple who was from Holland, they decided to retire in Portugal. Since they're in the EU, they can live anywhere over there. So they move, and the people that bought their house was this younger couple. And then another younger couple bought another house of an older woman who retired to Kansas City. And so we're having these young families come in, which is the best thing that can happen in these small towns. And they bring in these cool ideas. Like, I would have never thought about roasting coffee. I'm thinking about grinding up meat and pickling and making jellies, but roasting coffee, really? But they just get their green beans through the mail, and then however you roast coffee, they're doing it at home, I think in 5 or 10 pound batches. And it's delicious. And one time I accidentally ran out of coffee. You try very hard to never run out of food. You have these big pantries and extra freezers and stuff. But I ran out of coffee, which is the worst thing that could possibly happen. And so I asked my neighbor, you know, do you have some coffee? And he said, yeah, I just roasted some beans. And so it's like, I'll be right over with eggs. So I have chickens, and he doesn't have chickens.
You also, you made two women friends making Springerly cookies.
Yeah.
On wooden molds passed down through families. What are Springerly cookies?
You said that exactly right, Mr. Kraske, with a German name.
Yeah.
Good for you.
Yeah.
So I knew about these because I lived in Germany, and you have these wooden molds that are carved very intricately, and they make these little square cookies that when they're finished, you can make out like a little design, a little Santa Claus or a little squirrel or a cat or some leaves. And you make this dough, and it has a lot of egg white in it, so it makes this puffy white cookie a little bit like a meringue. But
this,
you let them dry before they go in the oven, and that's what makes the design stay baked in so they don't over-rise. And they're fabulous and delicious, and I hope I get to take part in that this Christmas time, because the last time, by the time I found out that action was going on, I had already made other plans.
If you're just joining us, I'm visiting with Cindy Hodel, formerly of the Kansas City Star, who now lives down in the Flint Hills, and we're talking about Flint Hills living. You mentioned the last time you were on that you and others are working to get the little bar back in Matfield Green. What's happening on that front? That's a big deal for this town, right?
That's a big deal, yeah. Because it's like the analogy would be in England or in Ireland, the function that a pub serves. That is what that bar was. It's not the same as a bar in Westport. That was the gathering.
So many. Yeah.
Right. This was a gathering spot for the whole county. And it's very important for people to come together. And also, it was our only fast food option. Like, if you didn't get dinner on the table in time, you were out in the garden till 9:30. Now what? It's a 30-minute drive to get to the closest restaurant. It might be 45 minutes to the closest one, depending on what day it is. So this is a huge deal. And so the little building is kind of beyond repair.
I've seen it driving through. I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. So one of our neighbors who lives half the time in Kansas City and half the time in Matfield, he purchased a 3-acre parcel of land, and he's going to take a deep breath and build a bar there and give the community a gathering spot back and a place to get maybe a burger and fries. Don't quote me on that. You know, this is still in the initial discussion phases.
When would it open?
No idea. Absolutely none. And getting contractors and people in to do stuff is a whole different deal in rural areas.
Yeah.
Some things take a little bit longer, but it's very exciting.
We're serving, Danny Alexander here, our producer, serving up some ratatouille here. And you going to take a bite, Cindy?
I was waiting for you first. So tell me the truth. Don't lie.
Oh, it's great. It's terrific. Yeah, very good. In fact, we have to keep talking. I just eat. It's about lunchtime here.
I can always talk. I can talk till the end of time. So.
Oh, it's terrific.
You could just keep eating. Mm. Yeah, I think...
I'll pass them around because that's worth sharing. Yeah.
The cheater version of this is if you have like a good organic tomato sauce in a can, you know, you can save some time by using a canned tomato sauce instead of making your own sauce. But what that simmering your own tomatoes in a lot of garlic and a lot of fresh basil, that just gives
so fresh.
Gives it this depth that you're not going to get with a canned tomato sauce.
Man, it just it's terrific. Just terrific. I want to run through some of your recent Facebook posts because you write about a lot of interesting things, Cindy.
Oh, dear.
You just wrote about a favorite memory trigger food, you called it, and for you it was peach cobbler. Why is that your favorite memory trigger food?
Memory trigger foods, like Proust famously wrote about the Madeleines in his book, you don't choose them, right? It's just like there. There's something about it. Whenever I bite into peach cobbler, I'm instantly transported back to, I'm 9 years old and I'm in Virginia. And this was something I'd never had before. And we had this lady who came and cleaned the house once a week. And my mother used to joke that she spent half the time making the peach cobbler and making a mess in the kitchen, then cleaning it up. But my dad didn't care because this peach cobbler was so fantastic. And I'm just back in that kitchen in Virginia, smelling this wonderful thing in the oven baking and watching it bubbling. And then the taste of it was, Rosie always came with a bag full of fresh peaches that she got at some roadside stand somewhere. And they were just dead fresh. The kind you bite into it and the juice is just running all down your arm. It was absolutely wonderful. And even as a 9-year old, I'm saying, how do you do that? How much sugar? And she used to say, God tells you how much. And she would just like scoop handfuls of sugar up out of the bowl and put it in. And it was, every time I take a bite of peach cobbler, it takes me there.
You just posted about a lightning storm that took you aback. Tell us about it.
Oh, wow. So like what a day of Mother Nature overload. I love driving in storms, but we had been up in Kansas City to see the eclipse at Weatherby Lake. And so that was fantastic. And then on the way home, after this incredible eclipse, total eclipse of the sun, driving home, I felt like I got this total eclipse of the dark because the lightning is kind of exploding in front of me on Highway 50. It was blinding. It was brighter than daylight. When you can see straight through the other cars and you can tell what color people's eyes are practically, you know, and the other vehicles on the road. And I've never seen lightning like that in my life. It was amazing and beautiful. And then, of course, out where I live in central and western Kansas, there's no trees and no buildings blocking the view. So you've got this 360-degree light show to the horizon. And that's what makes it all just bigger and more powerful.
You also posted about critters in horse troughs.
So
and covering those up.
My swimming pool And this is like a Petticoat Junction thing. So my swimming pool is a 6-foot oval horse tank, and it's just big enough for two tall people to be in at the same time and stretch their legs out in. And I fill it up with the hose. And then when we're done, I never have to put chlorine in it because I attach a hose to the bottom of it and use the water to water the garden. So I just put fresh water in it when I want fresh water. And what I learned the hard way is if you leave the water in overnight, if you don't drain it out, possums can fall in and drown. And then you feel terrible because I love possums. They're so cute. Some people think they're ugly, but I love them.
Yeah, you know, and just real quickly, you've gotten involved in politics. Give us the 30-second version of what you're doing right now.
Thank you for asking me that. Yes. I'm the chair of the Chase County Democratic Party, which had not been organized for a long time.
Yeah.
And this weekend I was up in Manhattan helping draft and pass the most progressive platform that Kansas has seen in a very long time.
And you've also been in Topeka worried about earthquakes.
Right. I also testified in front of the Kansas Corporation Commission pleading with the KCC to try to take seismicity. We know these earthquakes are man-made, and so take that into consideration when you're deciding whether to let people drill on fault lines and inject wastewater along fault lines.
Well, that's Cindy Hodel, our longtime friend who lives down in the Flint Hills, talking to us about life down there. Cindy, it's always a pleasure to have you here. Thanks for all your efforts to make the ratatouille. It was absolutely delicious, and as soon as we go off the air, we're going to be going right there, okay?
Steve, thank you so much, and I'm very impressed with your knife handling.
Next up, the latest State House blend, Missouri. Next month, thousands of Missourians will have to find a new way to pay for nursing home or in-home health care. That's because the General Assembly did not fund it in their budget, and Governor Eric Greitens vetoed a bipartisan legislative compromise to find the $35 million that was needed. This week, State House Blend Missouri host Brian Ellison was joined by Representative Deb Lavender and the Kansas City Star's Jason Hancock to talk about the vetoed bill and some possible solutions.
Jason Hancock, in the grand scheme of the state budget, which is it $27 billion or something like that, $35 million isn't that much money. Why did the governor veto this?
Well, first, I guess $35 million, here, $35 million there, eventually you're talking about real money, I suppose.
Right. But, let's keep things in perspective. That's true.
No, the governor vetoed this. He just didn't like the concept. He didn't like the idea that these funds with excess money were going to get swept up in order to fill this budget hole. He didn't believe it was constitutional. There's some question about that, whether it is or it isn't. It's my understanding they've done this before. But yeah, ultimately, he didn't like the bill. He criticized how it was passed. He criticized the funds that it did specifically mention. And he also have to remember, and this, the original proposal from the governor would have cut twice as many people out of this program. It was vastly more severe than what we're facing now. I think it was 20,000 people would have been affected. This cut affects about 8,000, give or take. We won't know the full number for some time, but so the governor was in favor of a much deeper cut at the beginning. So in some ways it's not really surprising that he was willing to swallow this cut to a smaller population of the most vulnerable people.
And Brian, if I can, where we do know the number is near 8,000, I want to make clear, too, that there are people who provide those services. So this is $34 million, $35 million that we're just taking out of Missouri's economy. So you might be the caretaker who goes in and provides services for one of those 8,000 people. So without that money to pay you, you are also then affected. And again, just taking this money straight out of the economy of Missouri, some of this money would be to go towards provider rates for nursing homes. There have already been 160 layoffs in nursing homes with a potential 2,500 more layoffs to come as we go through this year without this reimbursement to our nursing homes, which again takes care of our elderly Medicaid people. They've, done their work. They've paid their dues. Now it's our time to take care of them. And these people are also going to be affected with this cut.
So I guess my question is, now what for these people, these 8,000 or so people who will be affected? What's going to happen to them? Are there any other funding sources? Are there some creative solutions out there being proposed? Or are people literally going to go without care they need to get by?
Well, the first thing my caucus is going to be working on is trying to override the veto in our veto session of September 13th. And we think there is a huge outcry across our state for that to happen. I think that's the simplest way we can restore that at this time. And I think part of the reason there's such a huge outcry across the state is there's not an answer without these funds. There's nobody that's going to step in. There's nothing that's going to happen. And now these people, Brian, as you're saying, without the support maybe of family or friends to help, they will have to go to the emergency room. And then from the emergency room, they may need to be admitted. If you can't get out of bed, there's all kinds of complications that can happen for somebody who's disabled, living with disabilities. And so we also feel that the cost to the state is going to come back and get us anyway, as we're going to have to pay for more health care costs down the line.
You said you're going to seek an override of this veto. It was well short of the number of yes votes it would need to override a veto by the governor when it passed on the last day of the session. What do you think are the chances of that override succeeding?
Well, I'm always an optimist, and I feel a lot of my colleagues on the Republican side of the aisle have been hearing from their constituents as I have been. And I think there's a lot of reason for them to be looking at their vote and how it does affect people in their districts. And we will be working hard along with the people in the community who know the importance of this money, that many calls are being made to representatives to see if we can't get to that hurdle of 109 votes.
Are there any other, and I'll ask this of either one of you, are there any other options for this funding besides the sweep of unused funds that was part of this compromise? Let's say this veto does not get overridden. Is there a legislative solution to the problem that these individuals and families now face?
Well, Democrats would argue that they left with $100 million balance in the budget to cover emergencies and shortfalls. And they would say, this is an emergency. This is a shortfall that we should come back and appropriate money out of the surplus or out of the remaining balance. I don't want to call it a surplus, but to avoid these cuts and get us to the next legislative session to where a long-term solution could be worked out. Because let's stipulate that all of these are short-term fixes. Even HCB3, if it was overridden, which that's a big ask to get to 109 votes from 83, especially when leadership posed it during session. But even if you got there and you overrode the veto and you got this money put into the system, it's just a one-year fix. There still needs to be some solutions worked out next year to avoid these cuts in the future. So to answer your question, though, yeah, I think Democrats, when they've been speaking about this, they've been pointing to that balance that's left over that they built into the budget, saying this should be tapped in order to avoid these cuts. I think it would take a special session to do something like that. I'm not sure if the governor can shift funds around in that manner, but Representative Lavender might know more than I know. She sits on the budget committee, but that's the argument that I've heard from some Democrats, that we should be looking at that in balance.
I think that's a good one, and if we're not able to get to the hurdle of this override, I think there's still also the possibility of an appropriations bill using some of these monies that are sitting in our fund balances. We look at them as savings accounts. We have $3.6 billion sitting in 469 funds, and where I appreciate some of that money is hands-off, don't touch it. I think there's an awful lot of money when you've got $3.6 billion. We are truly talking about 1% of funds that we have in these balances, and balances that we have in these funds that truly can help our neediest at this time. So I think there are solutions. We just have to come to a consensus agreement for them.
Legislators have made clear they're not a fan of additional special sessions being called by the governor, but I gather that if this were the topic, you'd be supportive of that, Representative Lavender?
I would be. And if there's a good way that we can come to a consensus, I think we could be in and out of here in a very short time period being very mindful of the additional costs that these special sessions cost our taxpayers.
We would be remiss if we didn't ask you for your thoughts, Representative Lavender, on Senator Maria Chappelle Nadal. Earlier this month, she posted a Facebook message, of course, saying she hoped the president would be assassinated, and she's apologized. Is that enough? Should she resign?
Well, I think the senator stepped over a line, and even with her heartfelt apologies, leadership on both sides of the aisle have appropriately called for her resignation. I am concerned in these very contentious, hateful times, and in the wake of Charlottesville, I think we need to look at the response to the senator. She did something very inappropriate. She has apologized for it, and she is now receiving significant hateful rhetoric and has also included death threats. And I find that very troubling. I've not heard the lieutenant governor or the people calling for her resignation step up to condemn the responses that she's received. And I hope that they will do that, in that it should work for both sides. Where her actions are inappropriate, I think the backlash is very inappropriate also. I do think we need to be able to resolve this issue, that we can be able to really turn our attention again back on the troubles that we should be looking at, the health care, the education, the jobs, the roads and bridges. We need to keep our attention on those items. And I do think at this time the leadership calling for her resignation is appropriate.
We always turn over the program here at the end to our legislator guest to identify a song that captures this moment in the life of the Missouri legislature, and we go out with that song. Representative Deb Lavender, what song do you think we should go out with today?
I might give you a huge curveball. How about "When the Cannons Are Firing and the Bells Are Tolling" in the 1812 Overture?
I can't think of a more appropriate song. Representative Deb Lavender, Democrat from Kirkwood, thanks so much for joining us.
Brian, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to be with you this morning.
And from the Kansas City Star, State House reporter Jason Hancock. Jason, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Finally, I say for the last time today, State House Blend Missouri is produced by Matt Hodapp. Matt's been part of the show from the beginning, stepping off of an internship into a role here. But Matt is off next month to Chicago. From all of us here at KCUR, Matt, thanks for everything and all the best. I'm Brian Ellison. Thanks for listening.
Tomorrow, the latest in our Children's Health and Development series will get the nuts and bolts of infant sleep patterns. The veggies that we used in today's ratatouille came from the Thompson Country Farmers Market in Raytown. The kitchen was provided by Troy Lillibeau and KCUR's Brian Ellison. Many thanks to them. Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Coy Duggar produced our show. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.